from the Buddha. So you should view this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer sky, a flickering lamp, a phantom in a dream. From Crowfoot, who was one of the leaders of the Blackfoot American Indian tribe, what is life? It's the flash of a firefly in night. It's the breath of buffalo in wintertime. A Tibetan Rinpoche told me about a place near where he was born that's in a very isolated area in the mountains of Tibet, where the people have no access to matches. And of course there's no electricity or no gas for light, for warmth, or for cooking. So for these necessities of life, light, warmth, and cooking, a fire is necessary. To make a new fire without matches every day is quite a project, and it would take a lot of time. So the people in this area never let their fire go completely out. They keep a few hot coals burning through the night so that there's at least a coal or two in the morning to begin their fires for their cooking, for their warmth, and for their light. The Buddhist monks in this area practice so deeply with impermanence as their practice that at night they don't keep any coals, they don't keep any fire going, because they're so sure in the morning that they might not be alive. And also when they finish their last cup of tea at night, they turn their cup over to let the next person know that they finished, really finished. So in a certain sense, every night they prepare to die. They're ready. The deep knowing, the deep living with impermanence is an entryway, a gateway to liberation, a gateway to freeing the mind, freeing the heart. The only thing that we can know for sure is that everything changes. So, seemingly paradoxically, the only thing that we can hold on to is the realization, the intuitive insight of impermanence. The wisdom, the understanding of impermanence is really the bedrock of the Buddha's teaching. It was the initial insight that impelled him to leave the palace where he was born and grew up on his search for freedom, his search of a path to enlightenment, to liberation. Siddhartha Gautama grew up in very comfortable surroundings, very protected surroundings, in an area of India at the foot of the Himalayas that's now Nepal. His father and his mother were the king and the queen of the Sakyas in that area at that time. At Siddhartha's birth, a seer told his parents that this baby would grow up to be either an exceptionally wise ruler, or if he encountered enough suffering, great suffering, he would become a renunciate and a great spiritual teacher. So his parents, in order to keep him on the kingly track, they tried to protect him. They tried to protect him from encountering any suffering. And this is from one of the Buddha's discourses to his monks. Monks, I lived in refinement, utmost refinement, total refinement. My father even had lotus ponds made in our palace. One where red lotuses bloomed, one where white lotuses bloomed, one where blue lotuses bloomed, all for my sake. I used no sandalwood that was not from Varanasi. My turban was of silk from Varanasi, as were my tunic, my lower garments, and my outer cloak. A white sunshade was held over me day and night to protect me from cold, heat, dust, dirt, and dew. I had three palaces, one for the cold season, one for the hot season, and one for the rainy season. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I was entertained in the rainy season palace by minstrels, without a single man among them, and I did not come down from that palace during that season. But all of this protection and luxury and sensual pleasure couldn't keep him, couldn't keep Siddhartha. He wasn't satisfied. At one point, as young people are wont to do, Siddhartha decided that he wanted to go out on his own to see what life was like beyond the palace walls. So he asked his good friend and who was the chariot driver to take him for a ride through town. His father heard of this, that this was going to happen, and he ordered everything and everyone that might cause some disturbance to his son to be taken off the streets, to be taken out of view. But as we know, it's just not possible to have that much control over life. So not long before they were on the road, in the chariot, beyond the palace walls, Siddhartha saw a person walking down the road who was covered with oozing sores, a person walking with a great deal of difficulty, not looking well at all. And he'd never seen anything quite like this before in his protected life. So he asked his friend, what's this? What's the matter with this person? And his friend said, this is a very sick person. We all get sick. Everyone gets sick. You will. I will. Your parents will. All your friends will. At some point, every single person gets sick. Well, this was disturbing to this man, young man. And so he said, this is enough for today. Let's go home. They went home. He spent a restless night. But the next morning he wanted to go out again, so they did. Not long down the road, Siddhartha saw a person moving very, very slowly, bent over with a cane, very dry, wrinkled skin, very thin, wispy hair. And he'd never seen anything quite like this before. What's the matter with this person, he said. His friend said, this is an old person, very old person. Everyone gets old. You will, I will, your parents will, all your friends will. Well, again, this was disturbing to young Siddhartha. So he said, let's go home. They went home, spent another restless night. Next morning, though, he wanted to go out again. As they got a little bit closer to the village, Siddhartha saw a group of people all dressed in white walking down the road, and they were carrying a plank overhead with something on it that was covered with cloth. And the people were crying and wailing. He said to his friend, what's this? Why are they crying? What are they carrying? His friend said, they're carrying a dead body. That's what's on the plank. And they're crying because this person died. This is a funeral procession. Everyone dies. You will, I will, your parents will, all your friends will. Siddhartha said, enough, I want to go home. So they went home, and that night he barely slept at all. But the next morning, he wanted to go out again. So they did. Very soon, Siddhartha saw, he noticed a man walking down the road who was draped in orange cloth. This man was walking with a lightness, a grace and a flow about him, a kind of peacefulness and ease in his gait and in his demeanor. And Siddhartha said, who's that? His friend said, this man is a renunciate, a yogi. He's let go of his regular worldly life in search of the truth. Well, at that point, Siddhartha again said, let's go home. This is enough. As the story goes, because of Siddhartha Gautama's many lifetimes of development into an extremely sensitive, compassionate human being, the sights that he saw, sickness, old age, death, and a renunciate, struck him very deeply, very profoundly. These four encounters are called the four heavenly messengers. Siddhartha was very deeply struck by the impermanent, insubstantial nature of life that the first three messengers displayed, and the obvious suffering that he witnessed in relation to these first three encounters. He found himself very interested and quite powerfully drawn to what the fourth heavenly messenger represented, seeking peace, seeking freedom, seeking the truth. And again, from one of the Buddha's discourses after he became the Buddha. Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me, when an untaught person, himself or herself, subject to aging, to illness, to death, not beyond aging, illness, or death, sees another who is aged, ill, or dead, he or she is horrified, humiliated, disgusted, oblivious to himself that he or she is too subject to aging, illness, and death. If I, who am subject to aging, illness, and death, not beyond any of these things, were to be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another person who's old, sick, or dead, that would not be fitting for me. As I notice this, the healthy person's intoxication with youth, health, and life entirely dropped away. Why should I, who am subject to disease, old age, and death, seek that which is also subject to disease, aging, and death? And the Buddha went on to say, monks, there are three forms of intoxication. Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, intoxication with life. I overcame all intoxication, said the Buddha, with health, youth, and life, as one who sees renunciation as rest. For me, energy arose. Unbinding was clearly seen. One of the most prevalent myths that we live with, and often quite unconsciously, is the myth of things somehow staying the same, or the myth that we can control this changing experience we call life. The Buddha talked about how powerful and how consequential it is to experience just one moment absorbed in the feeling of metta, loving kindness, and that far more powerful and fruitful than the experience of a moment absorbed in the purity of loving kindness is when there's just one moment clearly seeing the rapidity of the arising and passing away of phenomena. The stage in practice where one knows very clearly and very surely the momentariness of all appearances. The powerful, direct experience and deep knowing of impermanence. The seed of liberation, the seed of freedom lies in this clarity of seeing and knowing. And this is from the Buddha again. What is born will die. What has been gathered will be dispersed. What has been accumulated will be exhausted. What has been built up will collapse. What has been high will be brought low. All conditioned things are transitory. Those who realize this are freed from sorrow. This is the path to freedom. Everything in this world, everything in this universe begins and ends, is born and dies, is constantly changing form. Every form of life, every object, every relationship, every sensation, every thought, every feeling, every mind state, every perception, every experience, every single breath. The world of form without, outside of us, and the world of form within, none of it is static. Our earth, it feels very solidly here. It seems quite permanently in place. Some time ago, I received a postcard from a friend. It had a really beautiful photograph on one side. A photograph of some sand dunes with a mountain behind them. It was quite a pleasure to look at. I turned the card over. And this is the explanation of the picture on the back. The gypsum forming these dunes originated from the dry flats 20 miles west of the park, deposited as seabed evaporites some 250 million years ago, when an ocean covered this area, creating at that time the limestone reef known as the Guadalupe Mountains. Approximately 10 to 12 million years ago, when this region was uplifted and erosion began, the eroding gypsum was left along streams and riverbanks, and later the prevailing southwest winds blew it up against the base of the Guadalupe Mountains. So I turned the card back over after reading that, looked at the picture again, with a different eye, you could say. And it was still a very pleasurable photograph to look at. I enjoyed looking at it, but something shifted. The places that we live in appear as though they have forever been the way they are now. Often our attitude, our actions reflect this. When I taught here in Israel 2 years ago, a place where there's so much strife about whose place it is, that's going on now and has been going on for centuries, I learned that Jerusalem, this city built of rock on rock, has been destroyed and rebuilt 13 times over the centuries. And this is a poem from Pablo Neruda, Chilean poet. We, the mortals, touch the metals, the wind, the ocean shores, the stones, knowing they will go on, inert or burning. And I was discovering, naming all these things. It was my destiny to love and say goodbye. We look up into the sky. No matter where we are on this planet, we see stars, familiar formations of stars. Anywhere we are on this planet, the same familiar stars, formations of stars. Old friends, when I travel a lot, I do travel a lot, and I look up and same old friends, you know. This is a short piece from a newspaper that I found a while ago. Our own Milky Way galaxy is on a collision course with another galaxy, but you won't need to buy that insurance just yet. The most likely scenario is that Andromeda would first swing by our galaxy. It then would take perhaps 100 million years to make a slow U-turn before plunging into the Milky Way's core. Another burst of star formation will then occur, with winds from the shock waves driving out remaining gas and dust. After that, old and new stars will intermingle to form an elliptical galaxy. There will be no trace of Earth, save perhaps for the 1970s-era Pioneer and Voyager probes that are now beyond the solar system. The fireworks aren't due for more than 5 billion years, long after the sun has burned out and reduced the Earth to a frigid cinder. 5 billion years from now, we'll all be dead anyway, says Hubble scientist Edward Wyler. I don't know if it takes a scientist to figure that out. However, if we move out to the stars someday, our descendants will certainly witness that from somewhere else in the galaxy. The word form implies for us a solidity, but in reality, all forms are forming and unforming, coming together and coming apart constantly without end. So our world can't be solidly objectified. Our world isn't a noun, it's a verb. It's constant, incessant activity. And most of the time we only know this as an abstraction, as a concept. We mostly know it intellectually. And actually, I think we more often forget it, or we ignore it, or we're constantly distracting ourselves from it by accumulating, by planning, by living in and out of memories, by fantasizing, by hoping, by expecting, by coveting, by fearing. If we rigidly hold on to how we want the future to be, and even as you probably well know by now how you want your next sitting to be, all of our energy gets used up in these thoughts. They're just thoughts. And then inevitably we come to have to face disappointment or anger or judgment. And we've missed the fullness of the present moment. We've missed what Thich Nhat Hanh calls our appointment with life. We're reinforcing, we're perpetuating the delusion, a false sense of control and permanence. Actually, much of the time, we're practicing permanence. Much of the time, we almost desperately want everything to stay as it is, or to continue as we know it, or to become the way we want it to be. So much so that we believe we have control, that things will do what we want them to do. But this belief is only make-believe, made-up beliefs. Our practice, as our practice deepens and we begin to see more and more clearly, we begin to discover that actually belief has little or nothing to do with reality. The tighter we grasp onto our beliefs, the more limited our life is. So, a good question you might ask yourself now and then, another question to ask yourself now and then: how often do I construct my life on this kind of flimsy, rickety foundation of make-believe, made-up beliefs, with all of their assumptions, sometimes misinformation, varying opinions and ideas about this and that, and hold on to this, all of it, quite tightly? How often do I do that? As we pay this kind of extraordinary attention, this mindful awareness to our experiences of body and mind, we begin to know, to actually touch directly, experientially, the constant rapidity of change. From the smallest, most minute micro changes in sensations, for instance, to the very large, macro-seeming solid substantiality of form, to the seeming substantiality of thoughts as they just fly through our mind. There's a story that I'm told is true about a physicist who did a great deal of research on matter and its components and its breaking down and finding nothing substantial. There's been in the last years, a lot of research in this area. And one of these scientists, it said that he went a little bit crazy. And he started wearing these great, big, huge padded slippers around just in case he fell through the floor, the insubstantiality of the floor. In reality, the very fabric, the very essence of life is change. So why do we fear? Why do we resist this perfectly natural phenomena, change? The beginnings and the endings, the births and the deaths. Why can't we surrender to the truth of the moment? Why do we resist and fear so much of life? Actually, without impermanence, there wouldn't be any life. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. If there is no impermanence, the grain of corn will remain a grain of corn forever, and you will never have an ear of corn to eat. Impermanence is crucial to the life of everything. Instead of complaining about impermanence, we might say, long live impermanence. Thanks to impermanence, everything is possible. This is a poem by Red Hawk. It's called "The Wheat Farmer Says Goodbye to His Only Daughter." His heart cracks like parched earth to see her go, but he is not free enough to weep. So he walks with her this evening out in the summer wheat, where the stalks beat softly. Suddenly, in his fertile anguish, his heart blooms, and like the last mad king of wild wheat, he grabs his child and twirls her. Through the sea of grain he whirls her, she holding tight, he boldly dancing in the moonlight. When at last they fall, he is winded and amazed. On his knees, he embraces her. And then she takes her leaving, like a wild wheat flower dancing, waving in the softly breathing wind. He watches her go weaving, moving slowly through the moonlight. And he fingers ripened grain in calloused hand. There's just one thing to do now, that his daughter is departed, to harvest cleanly and without regret. In this way he pays homage to the precious seeds he's planted. One blooms by rooting, one by blowing away. So looked at from these perspectives, change, impermanence, we could say it's actually an amazing natural marvel. This universal movement, constant change, cycling, the cycling of all of life on the planet. The possibility of immediate presence with the potential joys in this process, not getting caught up, lost in the hopes, the fears, the regrets. All of the life on the planet is dying all of the time, in the same volume as new life that brings such incredible beauty and joy with to us in the springtime, now, each spring, or the new day that greets us each morning when we wake up. This is from William Blake. He who binds himself to a joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So how might we move deeper into a deeper exploration and acceptance, this radical acceptance of the changing nature of things, the way of things, our nature as nature? There are many, many mirrors for us in our practice, in our life. The obvious mirror of the changing seasons all around us. The changing seasons within us. A number of years ago, during a three-month retreat that I was sitting at the Meditation Center in Massachusetts, Insight Meditation Society, I was taking a long, slow walk through the forest out behind the buildings. And it was during the height of autumn color. And in New England, it's quite colorful. I was seeing the ground as though carpeted with rich reds and shimmering greens and golds and browns and clear yellows. It was incredibly beautiful. I was quite immersed in the experience. And then all of a sudden, a knowing came in. Not through thought, though. Not at all through thought. But a very deep, intuitive knowing that this beauty is death, in a certain way. The world is dying in its unbearable beauty in that moment. And I cried a lot after that, for about 3.5 days. Not steadily, but a lot. When you're doing a three-month retreat, you have lots of time to cry if you need to. So I cried a lot, and quite deeply. In a certain sense, I was grieving the loss of the world, feeling my heart breaking, and at the same time, quite elated. It was an opening and a release And soon after that, a friend gave me this haiku. When with breaking heart I realize this world is only a dream, the oak tree looks radiant. And this is from a writer named Michael Rhodes. I think he's also a scientist. A leaf falls into the breeze onto the water's surface. Now begins the movement back to its original cellular form. Given a period of time, the base minerals of the vanished leaf will once again surge within new sap, moving within another leaf on another tree. From leaf to leaf, yet does one know of the other? So it is with humanity. Does present self know of other? Thus it is with all life. The movement never ends. Mortality is but a single moment in an infinity. This constant cycling, circling, this universal movement of life, from light to dark, from rainstorm to sunshine, seasons, the movement of the breath through the body. And this is from one of my favorite poets, Mary Oliver, who writes about this in her very unique and beautiful way. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go. Let it go. As we look more closely at our own process through our practice, we might begin to see that we've been living under a kind of assumed identity, the assumed solidity of our body and thoughts, which is often very quickly followed by the grasping on to thoughts, feelings, emotions, all of the habitual fixations we live with and believe and call me, call mine, and think that's who we are. As we practice, we begin to see, we begin to experience more and more directly and more often that things, that the phenomena of our life aren't necessarily as they appear, or at least as they've appeared up until now. We begin to experience the whole thing, or at least parts of it, as process just happening, as changing sensations, changing feelings, as various changing manifestations of the energies of mind and body, each with particular qualities, flavors, textures that are also constantly changing. And so our relationship to all of the forms, both inner and outer, begins to change. The compulsive, addictive grasping, trying to hold on to the passing show begins to loosen its strong attraction. Trying to control what's actually uncontrollable, ungovernable, as a friend of mine says, this ongoing miracle of constant change we call life begins to soften as we begin to open our hands, so to say. We begin to see how excruciating it is to grasp on so tightly. The fear that's underneath this impetus to control, the fear of being in and with life as it is, begins to relax, open, weaken. The fear begins to fade as we surrender more deeply to the truth of the moment. So now we're practicing impermanence. Occasionally people ask me, as you probably ask yourself, and maybe other people, friends who meditate, why do you practice? At one point I was asked this, and much to my surprise, out of my mouth came, I'm practicing for my death. And so it is. I am practicing for my death. On one level, so that I might actually have the possibility of being truly present with what we think of as the big death. But the momentary reality of practice right now, moment to moment, is that I'm practicing being present with the death of my conditioned self, the death of the habitually learned ways that keep recreating this assumed identity, this delusion of a separate, solid self. Seeing how selfing keeps happening over and over and over again. I'm practicing to see the death of who I think I am and the birth or the truth of who I am. There are hundreds, thousands, millions of little endings, deaths, moment to moment to moment. Breath by breath. It gets easier and easier to accept, to surrender to this as practice goes on. The assumed solidity, the assumed identity of me, of I, that's so frightening to let go of, is seen through our practice more and more as just process. Beginning and ending, again and again and again and again, every minute, every second, if we're really attentive. The acceptance of change, of the forming and the unforming, of the birth, the death, is actually truly the acceptance of life. All aspects of who we think we are just keep changing. What we think we want, what we think we need, our desires that seem so clear, so strong, so right, at any given moment, they can change, and quite rapidly. You've probably noticed that these last few days. For instance, we feel lonely. We want attention. We get attention. We're happy. We feel impinged on by the attention. We want it to end. We want it to go away. We're suffering. We're unhappy. Just a brief story. Again, a three-month retreat that I sat. Lots of stories come out of long retreats. I was feeling lonely. very lonely. And in good Vipassana fashion, I wanted a note for me on the note board. Mm-hmm. Wanted to someone to see me, recognize me, write to me, let me know I'm okay, they like me, they wrote me a note. No notes for me. It seemed like everybody in the whole retreat got notes except me. So I was very lonely. In the meditation center in Massachusetts, there's a small dining room in the back behind the big dining room. And there's a bunch of shelves up against a wall where people put their personal stash of things. Maybe vitamins, maybe things that they really think they must have that they're not going to get, like coffee, or we don't have coffee there, so, or candy, or who knows what, you know, different things. So I had a little stash in one corner, and one day in the midst of this loneliness, there was a little note on top of my stash. Oh, I was so happy. And the person next to me, it turns out, had left me a note and said, if there's anything from my stash that you would like, please take it. So I looked at it. Oh, green tea. I like green tea. Okay. I took some and I wrote him a note and said, thank you. I like green tea. And I felt wonderful. And the next day there was another note on my stash, on top of my stash. And it said, moving into November. It was getting cold. In Massachusetts, it can be very cold in November. The note said, I see you aren't wearing a hat when you go outside. I have an extra hat. Would you like a hat? Well, that didn't feel so good. I wrote back a note and said, I have a hat. If I need a hat, I'll wear my own hat. Thank you. Okay, but then the next day there was another note. And it was a practice question, a kind of a practice question, about something about transitions. And I wrote back a very sort of cryptic note, although I didn't think it was at the time, something about the fact that there are no transitions. And I had another note in my pocket that I'd written that said, please don't write me any more notes, because I wasn't happy with the attention anymore that 2 days ago I was craving. And fortunately, I never got another note after my transition note, so I didn't have to give him this other note. At the end of the retreat, we did speak. And we spoke about the noting back and forth. Like, very quickly. All relative conditioned states of mind. Totally dependent on a whole set of conditions. Which, the conditions themselves rapidly changing moment to moment. Emotional states of mind. Feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, changing very quickly. States of anger, of irritation, resentment, feel very solid, very, very solid at times. They seem very right, so absolute, these kinds of feelings. And as we've already spoken, anger being a very powerful, very energetic, very passionate energy. And to repeat a little bit here, with this clear attention directly into anger, seeing, knowing, and letting go of the self-referencing identification, this contracted, self-centered quality that's inherent in anger. Pulling out the thread of self, we could say. We can see clearly what's actually taking place, and our energy's freed up. This is the possibility of the transformation of anger into a mirror-like wisdom. For instance, forgiveness is a very powerful change out of anger. We might be able to forgive where we've been very solidly unforgiving as we open, experience, and see more directly, see more clearly, allowing the very natural, inevitable flow of change and its attendant emerging wisdom. we might not necessarily forgive an action. There are some actions that are very possibly unforgivable. But we might be able to forgive the actor. That's a possibility. We might be able to forgive, for instance, the ignorance that stems from a closed heart, or forgive a forgetful mind, either ours or someone else's. And then we can continue or maybe begin on some level to care about this person, maybe even love this person. Or at least see this person without blaming and begin to understand that it's the state of mind, it's the pain, the anguish, the confusion, the lack of awareness, it's the closed heart, it's the ignorance and the delusion that the action comes out of. No one acts in harmful ways to another unless they themselves are suffering. This new or changed relationship out of anger into some degree of connection within ourselves, then creating the spaciousness for healthy action. Grounded in compassion, grounded in wisdom, understanding. As we open and see more clearly, we begin to see ourselves with less and less judgment. And we see that we are also, to whatever degree, acting out of, and have in the past, acted out of ignorance. Acted out of forgetfulness, acted out of our old conditioned, habituated places of suffering. Many times ourselves. And so we change and we forgive where we've been very solidly unforgiving. Dogen, 13th century Zen master, defined Buddha nature as being impermanence. And he had this to say: we do not just have Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature. When things are seen in their fleetingness, their impermanence, not only is understanding great wisdom born, but also the other pillar of deepest insight, the great compassion, impartial care, love, heartfulness, that may include one's enemy. Many of us in this room, probably most of us in this room, at times have had a very strong identification with our face and our body in relation to how it looked when we were younger. We're taking another whole turn here and looking at from another angle. This identification with how we looked when we were younger. There are times when my mother, who is 88 years old, when she and I find ourselves standing in front of the mirror, looking in the mirror together. We don't plan the event, but it sometimes happens. We're looking at ourselves, we're looking at each other. At one point, we found ourselves doing this, and she was saying to herself and to me, kind of over and over again, "I see an old woman. It's so strange." And she kept repeating, "It's so strange, it's so strange, it's so strange. I see an old woman. I've changed so much. It's so strange to see." the most recent time that we found ourselves standing and looking in the mirror together, she said, "I look older than anybody else in the whole world." And then she said, "It doesn't match how I feel inside." And then she said, "How old am I?" And I told her, 88. She said, "How old are you?" I said, 60. She said, "I can't believe I have a 60-year-old daughter. It's so strange." And she started, "It's so strange, it's so strange again." Is it really strange? I mean, stranger than what? It's life. Life doing what it does. Life being itself. Sometimes life feels strange, yes. Have you ever looked in the mirror at your own face for a long time? Just really focused and looked in the mirror for a long time. It just keeps changing. Keeps on changing. If you've never done it, try it sometime. Whose face is this? Who is this face? Who sees? And this is another piece from Stephen Mitchell. His version of Narcissus. It was not the image of his own face that transfixed him as he bent down over the pool. He had seen that face often before, in mirrors, in 1,000 photographs, in women's eyes. It was an undistinguished face, but handsome enough, with its long eyelashes, full lips, and stately nose sloping to a curious plateau near the tip. No, it was something else now that rooted him to the spot. Kneeling there, gazing into the so taken for granted form, he grew more and more poignantly aware that it was mere surface. When the water was calm, it was calm. When the water rippled at the touch of a leaf or a fish, it too rippled or broke apart when he churned the water with his hand. More and more fascinated, he kept staring through the image of his face into the depths beneath, filled with a multitude of other moving, shadowy forms. He knew that if he stayed there long and patiently enough, he would be able to see straight through to the bottom. And at that moment, he knew the image would disappear. Again, the mirror of nature as a teacher of impermanence, and another three-month retreat story. I was sitting out behind the small dining room that I mentioned a bit ago, and I was watching the grasses each day into the autumn, fall season, actually watching particular blades of grass. Sometimes you get a little particular when you sit a long time. Fixated, it's sometimes called. So I was watching particular blades of grass. Sometimes people call it obsessive. And the grasses, it was fall. The grasses were drying up. So I was watching these particular blades of grass drying up, losing their color, changing their shape, curling over, and just noticing this quite acutely each day. Are we different than this? Are we really very different from this? What is the dharma of grass? No matter how much moisturizer we use, no matter how many vitamins we take and healthy food we eat, no matter how many long walks or yoga or tai chi or Rupa Lila we do, our skin dries out. Our hair loses its color. Our body changes shape. No matter who we are, no matter how hard we try, We just don't stay young. This mass of skin and bones, it has its schedule to keep, and there's nothing we can do about it. This is a poem by Elisel Mueller. My life is running away with me. The two of us are in cahoots. I don't know if you know that word. We're kind of in secret together. I hold still while it paints dark circles under my eyes, streaks my hair gray, stuffs pillows under my dress. In each new room, the mirror reassures me that I'll not be recognized. I'm learning to travel light like the juice in the power line. My baggage, swallowed by memory, weighs almost nothing. No one suspects its value. When they knock on my door, badges flashing, I open up. I don't match their description. Wrong room, they say, and apologize. My life in the corner winks and wipes off my fingerprints. This is a little bit of a long Dharma talk. And I want to read another poem by Red Hawk. It's called The Time Comes When It's Easier to Die. We have to go deeper inside like a tired miner chipping through stone. We have to dig even when we've had enough, and it's no longer worth it to get up out of bed. The morning is cold. The gray clouds move in like a flock of dark crows over a picked field. That's when we have to go deeper, through another hard layer of pain. You have to be relentless to make it in this place, because it will be relentless with you. It will never stop beating and grinding, wearing you down with one more thing gone wrong. Friends will die, or their nerves will fail. Women or men will cease to be thrilled with you, and your sorry efforts to hold it all together will come to nothing. You'll still tremble in the leg, go gray and dim in the face, leak more every year in your yellowed shorts. Don't be in a hurry to pack it in. The time will come when it's easier to die than to dig. The trick is to find the gold before death finds you, and then to sit there in the heart where you cannot be taken while death storms and rages all around you, stealing everything in sight, but only left holding a bag of bones. When I was 18 years old, my best high school girlfriend and I went to a place called Stratford, Ontario for a few days to see some Shakespearean plays there. And on our way home, it was a holiday called Labor Day in the States, we had an automobile accident. And my friend was killed in this accident. It was quite amazing. One minute she was alive, and she was driving the car, and we'd had these three really wonderful days together. And the next moment she was lying in the highway, right in the middle of the road, dying. And all I had were a few scrapes and bruises on my legs, my knees and feet. And I was washing her body with water, her dying body, and then she was just gone. It was an extremely powerful wake-up call for me. And not long after she died, I made the resolve that I would live life fully every moment, or every second, I think I said, because I knew now that life could end in a second. And of course, I've forgotten this resolve many, many times. But I've also remembered it many times. This whole experience with its very clear insight into impermanence was really, I think, a big part of what guided me towards spiritual practice, although in my 18-year-old self, I wouldn't have worded it that way. I wouldn't have thought about it or worded it that way. And it's been interesting to see over the years how this resolve to live life fully every moment has unfolded. It's been an ongoing process of letting go of many of the complexities, its seeming necessities of what we call normal life. So in a sense, living more fully has meant living more simply, allowing me to be more fully with the moments of living, the process of change, the beginnings, the endings, the births, and the deaths. This letting go or renunciation really means simplifying, letting go of that which doesn't serve awakening. And it unfolds quite naturally through our practice, our spiritual practice. Sometimes it's a conscious choice made between this or that. But very often it's just really a matter of paying attention, paying a very mindful attention, and really being present and responding however it's most appropriate, in whatever ways are most clearly the healthiest, both for myself and for others, at any particular time, in any particular situation, which inevitably means letting go of or renouncing some of one's habitual ways of engaging or not engaging inwardly and outwardly. And this is a little piece from a Cherokee, Native American Cherokee, a piece called Feast of Days. Autumn. Can there be anything more beautiful than the seasons of a tree? A tree stands in beauty from year to year and keeps its grace and dignity. We learn when we watch a tree. It constantly prunes itself, continually sheds any excess. The Buddha said that living a single moment, seeing the impermanence of all conditioned things, is more valuable than living 100 years without seeing it. It's so valuable because this clear seeing of impermanence leads to the end of suffering. A clear and sure insight into impermanence, seeing the knowing, really, very surely, seeing and knowing the momentariness of all appearances, leads to the understanding of the conditional nature of all phenomena, the selfless, empty nature of all things, which includes ourself. And this insight really being the seed and a primary fruit of liberation. And this is from the Buddha. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I, me, or mine. Whoever has heard this truth has heard all the Dharma. Whoever practices this truth has practiced all the Dharma. Whoever realizes this truth has realized all the Dharma. In our thinking, most of us assume that permanence provides security and that impermanence doesn't. But in actuality, although change may be very difficult and sometimes quite disturbing at first, it's really one of the gifts of life. What if nothing ever changed? Can you imagine? It would be the most incredible nightmare possible if nothing ever changed. A In 1985, my house burned down to the ground. And fortunately, no one was in it. No one was there when that happened. My three adult sons and I were visiting my mother, who was living in Mexico at the time. I received a phone call a couple of days after we'd arrived at my mother's house from a friend who lived down the road from my house. And he told me that my house burned down to the ground. Well, my first response to him was denial. I said, "You're kidding." But of course, who would call somebody up and tell them a joke, you know, like that? He wasn't kidding. Pretty quickly, I believed that he was telling me the truth. And I hung up the phone. I cried quite hard for about 15 or 20 minutes. My mother was standing right next to me, so she didn't know why I was crying, but because of how she is, she just put her arms around me and held me while I cried. And then I sat down soon after that and had a conversation with my brother, who was also visiting. We talked about 2 hours. And by the end of the conversation, the fire turned out to be a gift. I didn't have any things to hold me, to bind me anymore. In a sense, we could say the spiritual path burned its way open for me. You know, in Asian countries, it's not at all unusual for someone in their 40s or 50s whose family responsibilities are essentially finished to go and live the rest of their life as a spiritual life. And so to make a long story short, I ended up going to Asia for about a year and a half and practiced quite ardently, quite diligently. And then I came back to this country and continued similarly, practicing. If it wasn't for that fire, there's really a very good chance, I think, that I wouldn't be here with you in this way this evening. At least, I think it's a good possibility. That huge change that appeared at first to be a tragedy was really a great gift, and it's still unwrapping itself. And this is a very short haiku from Basho. "Since my house burned down, I have a better view of the rising moon." I'm going to finish this talk even though it's long. I hope it's okay with all of you. Not long before Carlos Castaneda, I'm sure many or most of you have heard of Carlos Castaneda, not long before he died, he and three of his friends were having lunch together. And I'd like to read you just a small portion of a piece that was written out of that lunch. This was a piece written by Michael Ventura. "There were four of us and Carlos. He was much thinner and older, obviously ill, but for all of his fragility, he seemed much livelier, happier, and even funnier. A woman at the table said she loved her job, her husband, her child, but still felt a lack. She had no spiritual life. How could she achieve a spiritual life? Answering this woman, Carlos didn't change the lightness or the generosity of his manner. Yet a steely thing came into his voice, a tone that made his words pierce all of us. He said that when she got home at night, she should sit in her chair and remember that her child, her husband, everyone she loved, and she herself were going to die. And they would die in no particular order, unpredictably. Remember this every night, and you'll have a spiritual life," said Carlos. Later in the conversation, this same woman asked how she could discipline herself to follow his advice, and follow it deeply, so that it wouldn't just be an exercise. And Carlos said, "You give yourself a command." On the page, there's no duplicating how he said it. He spoke quietly, but it was as though he suddenly jammed a knife into the tabletop. "What's that mean?" one of us asked. "It means you give yourself a command." And that was that. A command is not a promise. A command is not trying. A command is something that must be obeyed. His tone invokes something deeper than the idea of mere will. His was a call to action. He wasn't talking about mulling or analyzing or wishing. To step on the path, you step on the path. There's no substitute for that. As we touch and begin to accept with this radical acceptance the dance that life is in all of its manifestations, our life begins to take on a peacefulness, a deeper balance and equanimity, and a great appreciation and joy begins to blossom. We live so much more fully in the present moment, seeing all of the phenomena of body, heart, and mind, the whole dance and play of life around us, within us, as self-arising, self-liberating, coming in, going out, forming, unforming, continually changing. We're more and more with life, just as it is, within this very natural, innate spaciousness, openness, clarity of our awareness. As we wake up to this impermanent, conditioned nature of all phenomena, we less and less experience the feeling of missing anything. We're just simply responding to life here, now, in the moment, with a very authentic, bright liveliness as it dances through us and around us. We're just simply really here with the passing show. And again from the Buddha, this existence of ours is as transient as the autumn clouds. To watch the birth and death of beings is like looking at the movements of a dance. A lifetime is like a flash of lightning in the sky, rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountain. Living more deeply with the acceptance of impermanence allows us to respond more freshly to what in reality is completely new. A new moment, any moment, every moment actually. Never before met, never before experienced. And so we practice mindfulness, immediate presence. We practice seeing clearly. The truth of impermanence is a gateway. It's a gateway out of the feeling of separateness. It's a gateway out of self-centeredness. And it's a gateway into the experiential understanding of the truth that there's no separate, solid, static anything. No self. We begin to understand that we're all, everything, part of this intricate, endlessly changing reflective web of life. And we also really truly begin to understand the suffering in ourselves, the suffering in others, this anguish created by trying to hold on, the anguish created by resistance to the truth that every facet of life surrounding us and in us is not fixed, not permanent, not static. We and it are intricately interwoven, with everything constantly changing and everything reflecting everything in this many-hued and faceted jeweled net of life. And once again from Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. To be enlightened by all things is to remove the barrier between self and other. As understanding of impermanence deepens, it actually brings a great relief. A great relief and a lightness into our life. We no longer need to haul around such a heavy load. And there's the time and the energy available to live to our heart's content. From a Tibetan text, all thoughts, good, bad, happy, sad, vanish into emptiness as the imprint of a bird in the sky. And I'd like to close the talk, finally, with a poem from an Australian poet, Michael Lunick. He's also a cartoonist. And with each poem he writes, he draws a little cartoon. So I first need to describe the cartoon that goes with this poem. It's a line drawing of a man, and he's standing up, and he has his left arm stretched out, and in the hand of his left arm is a frying pan. And in the frying pan, there's a big pile of black stuff, and there's smoke billowing out of it. And he's looking at it with these big, wide-open eyes. And this is the poem that goes with the drawing. We give thanks for the invention of the handle. Without it, there would be many things we couldn't hold on to. As for things that we can't hold on to anyway, let us gracefully accept their ungraspable nature and celebrate all things elusive, fleeting, intangible. They mystify us and make us receptive to truth and beauty. We celebrate and give thanks. And let's just sit for a moment. Great patience in listening to the term. The person who's ringing the bell for the last set, maybe ring it at 5 minutes after 9, and we'll have a shorter set. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham Dharanam Gacchami, Stammam Saranam Gacchami, Sangam Saranam Gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Panatipata Vermani Sikapadam Samadhyami, Adinadana Vermani Sikapadam Samadhyami, Abrahmacharya Vermani Sikapadam Samadhyami, Musavada Vermani Sikapadam Samadhyami, Sura Mereya Majapamadatana Vermani Sikapadam Samadhyami, Idam Me Silam Magapalanyanasa Pachayo Hotu. Imaya Dhammanu Dhammapatipatiya Buddham Pujami, Imaya Dhammanu Dhammapatipatiya Dhammam Pujami, Imaya Dhammanu Dhammapatipatiya Sangham Pujami, Aham Avirohomi Abhya Pajohomi Anigo Homi Sukhiyatnam Pariharami, Mama Mata Pitu Acharyacha Nyatimitacha Sabrahma Charinocha Awarahantu Avyapajahantu Anigahantu Sukhiyatnam Pariharantu. Imasmim Arame Sabe Yogino Avwerahantu Avyapajahantu Anigahantu Sukhiyatnam Pariharantu. Amhakam Araka Devata Imasmim Vihare Imasmim Avase Imasmim Arame Araka Devata. Avwerahantu Abhyapajahantu Anigahantu Sukhiyatnam Pariharantu. Sabe Sata Sabe Panna
Sabbe Bhuta, Sabbe Pugala, Sabbe Atavava, Pariyapanna, Sabba Itiyo, Sabbe Purisa, Sabbe Arya, Sabbe Anarya, Sabbe Deva, Sabbe Manusa, Sabbe Vinipatika, Awarahantu, Abhyapajahantu, Anigahantu, Sukhiatnam, Pariharantu, Dukha Muchantu, Yata Lata Sampatito, Mavigachantu, Kamasaka, Idam no Punyabhagam, Sabhasatanam, Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu.